So as I said, this training is being recorded and will be offered on demand for those not able to join us live. The Clumen training page that brought you here today offers the slides available for download if you'd like to review them at your own pace or at a later time. Please use the Q&A pod to ask questions, make any comments, or report any technical problems that you encounter during today's training. We will have two question and answer breaks, the first about halfway through the modules and the last one at the end of the training today. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available upon the completion of the feedback form at the end of the training today. Once you complete the form and click the box to certify that you participated, a certificate will be emailed to you. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, I would like to welcome everybody to today's training, ITRC Strategies for Preventing and Managing Harmful Cyanobacteria Blooms. My name is Devin Sechkar. I'm your moderator today. This training is an introduction to the ITRC online guidance document of the same name produced by ITRC in 2021. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. We are a state-led organization composed of members from state agencies, the federal government, academia, the private sector, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. For those just entering the room, we just covered some logistics and now we're gonna head into the intro, but if you have any questions or comments you'd like to make, please put those in the Q&A pod. So before I turn it over to our expert trainers today, I'd like to set the stage with some general information. So why is it important to have a guidance document focused on cyanobacteria? Cyanobacteria are native species found in nearly every type of aquatic environment, lakes, rivers, wetlands, even damp soil. In lakes, ponds, and rivers, they can become very abundant, forming masses of cyanobacteria known as blooms. Under some conditions, they may also produce compounds that are harmful to people and animals called cyanotoxins. Every year, locations around the U.S. report blooms that have been linked to human illnesses and, in some cases, animal deaths. This causes impacts to recreation, drinking water, farming, and wildlife. The current science indicates that the future is bright for cyanobacteria. Environmental conditions around the world are increasingly expected to move towards those that cyanobacteria love. A warming climate means longer growing seasons and warmer lakes in areas that don't have them right now. Increasing precipitation means that more surface runoff reaches our waters, and that runoff is expected to carry more of the nutrients that cyanobacteria needs to grow. So more places to live and lots of food to grow. We need to be thinking now about steps that we can and need to take to make it more difficult for cyanobacteria to flourish. The ITRC guidance document built on the extensive experience of the ITRC HCB team members from 2018 to 2020. Team members represented federal, state, and local experiences, natural resources, and public health staff, scientists, and people that live around lakes. Not everyone has experienced or responded to HCBs in the same way, and having these diverse perspectives was key to building the guidance document that we're proud to present today. The team discussed what worked and what didn't, and what aspects of cyanobacteria management are important to consider. The ITRC team purposely brought all aspects of cyanobacteria response together into one document. The ITRC document shares successful approaches used around the country and links you to the resources that explore as you learn more about cyanobacteria management and responses. So with that, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers today that are gonna talk to us about cyanobacteria management and response. So with that, I'd like to first pass it off to Gina La Liberté from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to get us started.
Thanks, Devin. All right. There we are. Go back one. Today, I'm going to be reviewing the HCB introduction, which you can find in section 3 of the HCB guidance document. I'll be giving a brief introduction to cyanobacteria biology and ecology. I'll be reviewing the terminology that's used in the guidance document, and I'm going to briefly go over the health concerns that are associated with HCBs and current regulations and guidance. So to start with some basic information about cyanobacteria, they are naturally occurring and are widely distributed across both aquatic and terrestrial environments. In the guidance document, we focused on those in freshwater and estuary habitats. They do have some beneficial ecological roles, such as serving as a food source for other organisms, providing oxygen via photosynthesis, and some are able to fix nitrogen, atmospheric nitrogen, into a form that's usable by algae and plants using the specialized cells that you see indicated by the arrow. Cyanobacteria do have some unique characteristics that help them to form persistent blooms, including forming resting or dormant stages, such as this enlarged cell that you see indicated by the second arrow. Planktonic cyanobacteria, which float in the water column, can regulate the buoyancy using the gas vesicles that you see as the dark bodies in the cell indicated by that bottommost arrow. So, what do cyanobacteria look like, and how can you tell them apart from other green things in aquatic systems? We have a great visual guide to common harmful cyanobacteria, which is in Appendix A of the guidance document. We also have a video on how to identify cyanobacteria blooms. The visual guide has field photographs of blooms in microscopic images, and it covers cyanobacteria by what form they grow in, such as in colonies or filaments, and by what habitat they grow in, such as planktonic in the water column, versus benthic, attached to surfaces or on sediments on the bottom of aquatic habitats. It also includes examples of things other than cyanobacteria, such as plants, filamentous algae, and other kinds of algae, as there are many things that are commonly mistaken for cyanobacteria. So now I'd like to review some of the terminology that we used in the guidance document. When we're talking about cyanobacteria, we're talking about blue-green algae. Cyanobacteria is just a more scientific term since cyanobacteria are actually true bacteria that photosynthesize, and the group that's considered to be algae can encompass things other than bacteria. It's important to remember that not all harmful algae blooms, which are known by the acronym HABS, HABS, are actually harmful cyanobacterial blooms, for which we use the acronym HCBs, and which you may have seen elsewhere as cyanohabs. There are other algae that can form HABS or nuisance blooms in freshwater or marine habitats. So the bottom photo that you see here is Spirogyra, which is a filamentous green alga, and you can see that it superficially resembles the HCB in this photo at the upper right. So the terms that we use for cyanobacterial accumulations can vary based on the location and type of accumulation. They can also intergrade, or there might be more than one type present. So blooms are visible accumulations of cyanobacteria in the water column. You can see them as discolored water, as you see in these two photographs. The guidance document focuses on planktonic cyanobacteria, which float in the water and which might be concentrated at the surface, throughout the water column, or at a depth. So, planktonic cyanobacteria can form scums, which are accumulations on the surface of the water, which typically occurs during a period of calm weather. Or floating cyanobacteria might also be concentrated by wind at the downwind shoreline of a lake or other water body, which you see in these two photos. And finally, what you see in this photograph isn't planktonic cyanobacteria, but there are benthic cyanobacteria that can grow as mats on sediments or surfaces on the bottom of the water body. And these can float to the surface as nuisance accumulations, again, as you see in this photograph. ITRC has benthic HCB guidance, which is linked from the planktonic HCB guidance document on the website. So what are the things that promote HCB growth? Previously, I just covered the different types of HCB accumulations. So what are the factors that promote cyanobacterial growth to HCBs? The specific environmental conditions that promote HCBs can vary by the water body and by the cyanobacterial community growing in it. But in general, cyanobacteria grow and accumulate into HCBs with favorable environmental conditions that include an increase in nutrients. So both phosphorus and nitrogen are needed to fertilize HCB growth to high concentrations of cells. Increases in water temperature can play a role as cyanobacteria are adapted to grow better at warmer water temperatures than other kinds of algae. And then finally, hydrological stability, whether that's stratification in a lake, slow flow in a river system, or reduced turbulence, can provide conditions that allow planktonic cyanobacteria to concentrate near the water's surface as blooms or scums. We do need to keep in mind that climate change can enhance the environmental factors that promote HCB growth. Warmer temperatures and longer growing season create optimal growing conditions and promote the persistence of HCBs from 1 year to the next. Periods of drought enhance hydrological stability via stratification or by slowing river flow. And then finally, a very important factor is that we're seeing intensifying rain events in most of the United States, and heavy rain events can bring nutrients into aquatic systems via runoff. So, what is it that actually makes cyanobacterial blooms harmful? We consider HCBs to be harmful because some can produce cyanotoxins and other irritants that can cause serious health effects in people and animals. These compounds include hepatotoxins that affect the liver, neurotoxins that affect the nervous system, and dermatoxins that affect skin and mucous membranes. Cyanobacteria can also make other types of compounds that can cause general irritation and allergic type reactions. HCBs can also have adverse environmental effects. When large blooms decompose, that can cause low dissolved oxygen. HCBs can also increase shading that impacts aquatic plant growth. So I'm going to talk a bit now about cyanotoxin production and release. Toxin production can really vary over time and space. It's important to remember that not all cyanobacteria can produce toxins, and those that can don't make them all the time. Something that we need to take into account when it comes to monitoring cyanobacteria is that multiple toxin types may be produced by a single species. And in general, toxins are held within intact cyanobacterial cells, so toxins are considered to be intracellular. There is an exception for the toxin called cylindrospermopsin, which can be released into the surrounding water from actively growing cells. For the other intracellular toxins, those are not released to the water or become extracellular until the cell dies and lyses and the cell wall is broken open. This can happen gradually, such as when a bloom naturally decays, or it can happen suddenly, such as when a chemical treatment is applied to an HCB or if cells are ingested. So, how are humans and animals exposed to cyanobacterial blooms and cyanotoxins? Potential exposure can occur near a water body containing an HCB. This can happen if you accidentally swallow affected water that contains cyanobacteria and their toxins. You can also be exposed if you breathe in aerosols from water spray or mist, such as by water skiing over a lake containing an HCB, or through direct water contact with skin. Another exposure route is by ingestion of contaminated drinking water or food. Animals can be especially at risk from HCBs and their toxins because they tend to have a higher exposure while drinking and swimming in affected waters. Animals don't avoid contact with water that people would normally not want to touch. Animals can be exposed from ingesting the cyanobacteria that they groom from their fur or feathers, or by intentionally eating scum or mat material that's washed up on shore. Children can have a higher risk because of their smaller body weight, so it doesn't take ingesting as much cyanotoxin to make them ill as it does for an adult. Children also tend to spend more time in the water and have more hand-to-mouth behavior, which can increase their exposure. So, given the risks, what regulations and guidance do we have for HCBs and cyanotoxins? Currently, we do not have federal standards for cyanobacteria or cyanotoxins. However, we do have guidance from the US EPA for the toxins microcystin and cylindrospermopsin in both recreational and drinking water. In March 2021, the World Health Organization released recreational guidance for four toxins: microcystin LR, anatoxin A, cylindrospermopsin, and saxitoxin. Additionally, many states have developed their own regulatory or guidance values for HCBs and cyanotoxins. However, those tend to be focused on planktonic HCBs. Guidelines for benthic cyanobacteria are lacking. Please see the ITRC benthic HCB guidance for more background on this. So, please stay tuned for the next modules in this training, which will cover guidance and selection tools to help you develop a management plan for HCBs. Next, we will cover monitoring for cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins. Other modules address communication and response plans, in-lake management and control methods, and nutrient reduction as a strategy to reduce HCB occurrence. So, next, we'll have Ben Holcomb covering monitoring.
Great. Thank you, Gina. Thanks for the introduction. Here we go. In this section of our HCB training, I'll be talking about how to monitor. I'll talk about the analytical methods used to evaluate cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins. And then I'll also be covering field collection methods, basically how you fill the bottle that is used to evaluate the conditions of the water. I'll demonstrate the use of the interactive selection tool the team's developed to help you explore which analytical methods may be most useful for your water body and your goals. And finally, I'll talk about the elements of a cyanobacteria monitoring program. And when we finish this section of today's training, you should have a basic understanding of how to design and conduct a monitoring program to meet your needs. So let's start with how we monitor for cyanobacteria. Monitoring provides the data you need to describe the conditions that you're seeing. For HCBs, that means cell counts and measures of cyanobacteria and the cyanotoxins. They will help you describe what kind of cyanotoxin or cyanobacteria is present and how much there is, when and where it was found. You may also choose to include water quality parameters that describe conditions that support HCB growth, or how HCBs are affected by management strategies that you've taken in the lake or in the watershed. And I'll talk more about those a little bit later. So the most important objective when monitoring for HCBs is to support your HCB response plan. Your response plan tells you what to do when a bloom is reported and outlines what level of cyanobacteria or cyanotoxin will require you to act, such as closing a beach or posting signs along a recreational path. You'll learn about response plans in the next segment of our training, and I can read more about it in section five. As I mentioned before, HCB monitoring can support your HCB management activities. Actions to control cyanobacteria can be focused in the lake itself, such as the application of phosphorus binding chemicals, as you see in the photo here, or be undertaken in the watershed to reduce the source of nutrients that encourage the growth of cyanobacteria. If you decide to include monitoring for management success in your HCB program, you'll want to begin monitoring before the management action starts so you can characterize the cyanobacteria community before the conditions change. After your management begins, you can continue to monitor using the same methods so you can track how the community responds to your management tools. And more on this monitoring approach will be discussed in the management and control section later in today's training. So, monitoring plan is all about your needs. It'll identify the methods you'll use in the field, specifically making sure you get the data you need for the actions or alert levels called out in your response plan. Because you know how often you'll sample, the cost of the analyses, and the number of people you'll need to do the work, you can get a budget for your program. And this is important to keep you from spending all your funding in June when you know blooms will still be occurring in August and September. A plan also helps create and maintain consistency across time. When a bloom occurs, things get hectic fast. Lots of people are calling for information. Lots of people have concerns about their health. So having a plan means you don't have to think about these long-term things and what's appropriate to collect or where to go. You've already decided that. So having a plan also means you collect the same data in the same way each season and can better compare current data to past experience or track trends over time. The terms monitoring and sampling are often used interchangeably. However, they do have different meanings. In our guidance, sampling refers to the collection of a single point of data in response to a bloom. As you see, the person in the photo filling a bottle from a visible scum. Monitoring is the collection of routine data that detect impending blooms or track changes over time. Monitoring represents a series of samples, including some that may be collected in response to a bloom situation, but monitoring is mainly visiting the same locations at set intervals, regardless of whether a bloom is present. So let's turn now to the actual methods used to measure cyanobacteria. Our guidance document discusses six methods commonly used to decide whether cyanobacteria are present and how much might be there. You can see the methods here on the slide. They range from simple methods that require minimal training and not many tools to those that are more complex, requiring specific training and often very complex equipment. Each method is evaluated using the same set of criteria. You can see the criteria on the screen here. We discuss, for example, the kind of result the method provides, cells per mil, say, or micrograms per liter of chlorophyll A. In the document, there's a summary of these criteria for each method so that you can easily compare one method to another. It's very important that you understand the criteria we use. We've provided a definition of each in our guidance, and you should take a look at that to be sure your interpretation of what criteria means matches ours. Consider turnaround time, for example. We define turnaround time as the time needed to prepare the sample, run the analysis, and get the raw data. If you're sending a team into the field to collect a sample, that time is not included in our definition. To fully estimate how much time it'll take before you have data to share, you need to add the field time to the turnaround time. If your sample location is located far from your lab, there are very few methods that'll get data to you in less than a day. There's one very important thing to remember about cyanobacteria methods. They do not provide any information about cyanobacteria toxins. It's not possible to use any of these methods to tell you what kind of cyanotoxins may be present. You must use a method designed specifically to test for cyanotoxins. So with that said, let's turn now to look at those methods that test for cyanotoxins. Our guidance covers six methods commonly used for evaluating cyanotoxins. Like the cyanobacteria methods, they range from those that are simple and require minimal tools to those that require specialized training and equipment. Similar to the cyanobacteria, we use a single set of criteria to evaluate each method and summarize them in a table associated with each method so you can easily compare them. There are some key things to remember about cyanotoxin analytical methods. No single method can provide information about all toxins. You cannot fill one analytical method, or you cannot fill one bottle, run it on a machine one time, and quantify all cyanotoxins. There are several analytical methods for toxin quantification depending on your needs. Additionally, guidance values may not be available for all cyanotoxins. Guidance values help you understand the meaning of your toxin result. So 4.5 micrograms per mil of microcystin is just a number without that guidance telling you how to interpret and use it. There are federal guidance values for several cytotoxins, and some states have also developed their own. As you build your monitoring plan, it's important to know what guidance values are applicable to your water body. Another thing to remember is that there might be interference from compounds, environmental or otherwise, when analyzing your samples. It's important to understand your method and possible interferences so you can use the proper bottles, preservation, or otherwise minimize their effect on your analysis. Your samples may require a specific prep or extraction. This is especially important for plant and animal tissues. They require very different preparation from water samples. These preparation methods are continually changing and improving, so it's important to review available methods and use the best sample preps for your goals. Finally, it's also important to remember that cytotoxin results tell you only about conditions at the time you filled your bottle. They can't tell you about what happened 2 days ago or predict what will happen 2 days or 2 hours into the future. They're a snapshot of one point in time, and you need to keep that in mind. So let's talk now about sample collection methods, how you fill the bottle that will be used in the lab. We created a flow chart to help you decide which field methods to use. So you see a part of that here. The full flow chart is in the guidance document. And essentially, you select the water body type, for example, still water versus flowing water, possible locations of the sample, and then you can see which methods may be appropriate. The location of the HCB is important in deciding which field sampling approach to use. So we've developed a graphic to remind you of possible locations for HCBs that you'll find in our guidance document. If you're looking at a floating HCB, you'll use methods for plankton. If the HCB is located on the bottom, attached to plants, or washed up on the shore, you'll use benthic approaches. If you're interested in cytotoxins that may be in the water, that is extracellular toxins, you'll use another set of methods. The HCB1 guidance document is focused primarily on planktonic or floating HCBs, but we've added a new document, HCB2, with information about benthic HCBs and training focused on benthic HCBs and HCB2 will occur separately next Thursday. Let's talk now about how to build a monitoring plan for your water body. A monitoring plan is the story of what you're going to do. It tells everyone why you're sampling, when, where, and how you'll sample, as well as who will do the work. A monitoring plan for Largeville Reservoir here, for example, this fictional lake, would consider a monitoring plan to meet the needs of all the stakeholders on the lake, federal, state, and county facilities, the two drinking water facilities, as well as boating, swimming, and the fishing public. As you consider developing a monitoring plan for a location like Largeville Reservoir, you'll want to consider the sustainability of that program in the long term. Your budget needs to include sufficient resources to cover staff, analytical costs, training, any quality control requirements. As I mentioned before, for a large water body that is subject to frequent blooms, monitoring costs can be high if you try to do all of those things. It's important to find that sustainable balance between getting all the information you want and the basic information you need. So partnerships with stakeholders around the water body can help with that sustainability. If you consider Largeville Reservoir, there are several stakeholders who could assist with your monitoring, such as beach and boat launch managers who can, since they're there, report daily on the cyanobacteria conditions. Drinking water facilities may be able to cover the costs of some of the cyanotoxins that may impact them. And of course, always be looking for other options. Don't forget to consider whether there are additional environmental conditions you'd like to track along with cyanobacteria. Adding something as basic as water clarity measurements as shown here on our slide. To your monitoring visits adds only a little time and the cost of a SecuDisc, for example. It's a simple measure that may allow you to evaluate both cyanobacteria presence and the effectiveness of your BMPs. Now I'd like to demonstrate the use of our monitoring tool to evaluate which analytical methods might be appropriate for your lake. So we'll go back to this Largeville Reservoir as an example of how you might build a monitoring program. Let's say there have been no previous bloom reports on this water body, so there's no monitoring program in place currently. However, a dog illness has been reported from the county boat ramp. The state investigated the area and confirmed the presence of both cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins. They recommend a monitoring program be developed for the reservoir. Because this is the first bloom reported from Largeville Reservoir, they don't have a cyanobacteria response plan to follow. However, they have some basic information they'd like their monitoring program to provide. They'd like to be able to learn quickly about cyanobacteria conditions so they can communicate rapidly with the public. They'd also like to monitor in such a way to get heads up when conditions may indicate a bloom is forming. And finally, they want to make sure that their monitoring provides information for the drinking water facilities, the recreational activities on the reservoir, and to keep pets safe. So this slide shows how this monitoring tool appears on our website. It includes all the criteria that we use to evaluate each method. Three of these criteria allow you to whittle down the list of 12 methods to those that are of more interest. For example, if we want to find those that are the fastest, we'd uncheck the box indicating a lab is required, and we'd also uncheck the box for a turnaround time of 1 to 3 days. This will get us to the quickest methods for cyanobacteria and cyanotoxin. So when you make those selections, this list of cyanobacteria methods appears. Note that I couldn't include the cyanotoxin methods on the slide because of the space. The list of methods appears on the left side of the table. All methods are hyperlinked directly to the guidance documents so you can easily read about them. The first six columns are color-coded, where green indicates the method is appropriate for the criteria, red indicates that it's not. So let's look at the first three criteria under cyanobacteria. The first, PA, refers to the ability of the method to tell you whether cyanobacteria are present or absent. All four methods have green circles, meaning they can be used to tell cyanobacteria are present. The next criteria, ID, refers to the ability of the method to identify to the genus level, whether you have microcystis or dolichosperma, for example. All circles here are red, indicating these methods can't do that. The third criteria, DEN, refers to the ability of the method to evaluate the density of cyanobacteria, and you can see that two of the methods can be used for this while the other two cannot. All three of the cyanotoxin criteria have red circles, reinforcing what I said earlier, that this cyanobacteria methods can't tell you whether cyanotoxins are present. You can also use the monitoring tool to quickly compare all the methods to one another. If, for example, you're looking for methods that are lower in cost, you'd read about those methods indicated by the $1 or $2 signs. For those that can be done by just about anyone, you'd look at those identified as having a level of training at a novice or intermediate level. Again, all the methods are hyperlinked directly to the text for the method in the document, so you can quickly and easily compare each of these methods to one another. All right, so let's wrap up the discussion on monitoring by reviewing the key things I'd like to remember when you're building your monitoring plan. First, be sure to identify your goals and choose those analytical methods that get you the data you need. If your guidance says beaches will be closed when cell counts exceed 100,000 cells per mil, using a visual assessment will not get you the information you need to close a beach. Use our monitoring selection tool to evaluate methods and find those that meet your needs. Build your monitoring plan to tell the full story, the who, what, when, where, and why, and make a plan to meet your needs. Your needs are outlined in your HCB response plan. and may also be incorporated into an HCB management plan. Finally, consider how to make your plan sustainable in the long run so you can compare current and past conditions. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Devin so we can get to our first set of questions.
Thanks so much, Ben. So we'll jump right into this first Q&A, and I'm going to look to our Q&A pod here to see if we have any open questions for our trainers. And just to remind everybody, we will have another opportunity to answer questions live at the end of the training as well. So with that, I'll just pause for a moment here and see if we get any questions in. If not, we can save the time up for the end if we get some more questions in and move on to the next module. While we're pausing, I'll just use this time to just let everybody know that ITRC does archive all of our live trainings, and they are located on the Cluin training page under the archive sessions. I'll put that link in the chat for everybody if you're interested in any training topics or anything like that. We have lots of great courses that you are able to view on demand at any time. And then I will also put in the link to our HCB Benthic Teams webinar as well, which is the second part that our trainers have mentioned here today for anybody who is interested. But if you registered, which you obviously did for this one, then you are registered for the HCB 2 course as well. So with that, it doesn't look like we have any questions here for our first Q&A session. So Gina, I'm going to just hand it to you for communication and Bloom response planning.
All right, great. So in this portion of the training, we're going to talk about how you can use risk communication and risk communication planning to improve your response to harmful cyanobacterial blooms, which we refer to as HCBs. We're going to cover the basics of risk communication, response during a bloom, and long-term planning to prepare for blooms for the future. So you may be wondering what risk communication is and how it's different from other forms of communication. Risk communication offers a science-based approach for communicating effectively in situations that are high stress, unfamiliar, or controversial. It provides people with the information they want or need to make informed decisions about threats to their health and safety. And like all effective forms of communication, it customizes messages to meet the needs of different audiences. Effective risk communication helps you to build a good relationship with your audience, a relationship that's based on shared goals, values, and problem solving. The following risk communication best practices can help you cultivate that relationship during a bloom event. Start by learning what your audience knows about the risk and listening to their concerns. Convey information in a way that your audience can understand. Combine understanding and empathy into your explanations of risk, and build trust and credibility through accurate information and frequent updates. Consistent, concise messaging is critical to effective risk communication. Message mapping helps you to create brief yet comprehensive messages. The message mapping process helps you identify three short key messages that answer questions about who, what, when, why, where, and how. Remember, when people are under stress, they have difficulty understanding and retaining information, so take that into account when developing your messages. Your key messages should include information about health risks, health advisories, and water-related activities that may threaten human or animal health. Once you've developed your key messages, coordinate and collaborate with other credible sources to help reinforce these messages. And finally, meet the needs of the media. They can help you get your messages out, but only if you organize your information and provide it to them in a timely manner. Preparation is the key to successful risk communication. That's why it's important to have a plan in place before you need it. A plan helps you to identify issues as well as your potential audiences and their needs, create clear and concise messaging, and anticipate problems so you can address them beforehand. That's also important to evaluate your communication efforts after the fact and see what worked and didn't work and make adjustments to your plan. If you're interested in more information about how to develop a risk communication plan, consult the ITRC Risk Communication Toolkit on the ITRC website. So harmful cyanobacterial blooms require two types of planning, an immediate communication and monitoring response plan to be used during the bloom, and a long-term response plan that's built and updated during the off-season. This training and the accompanying HCB guidance document will help you prepare these two types of plans. Immediate HCB response planning consists of five key elements: reporting, notification, and coordination, bloom confirmation, drinking water source identification and response, issuance of health advisories, and reporting on HCB-related illnesses. So let's take a few minutes to walk through each of these key elements. It's critical to establish effective reporting and notification methods so you can respond quickly and efficiently when a bloom occurs. You'll want to develop a reporting mechanism that can be used by partner agencies, stakeholders, and members of the public, and make sure that all bloom reports go to a centralized location. You'll also want to set up a process for alerting other organizations such as the health department, state parks, or lake managers to let them know that you've received a report of a bloom. Once you've notified your partners, coordinate a bloom response that might include sampling or site visits. And finally, you want to notify the public when you confirm the presence of an HCB. Tell the public what you know and that your data are preliminary. Outline the steps you'll be taking to ascertain the severity of the bloom and let them know when you will provide them with an update. After you receive a bloom report, you can use visual observations to help you determine if the suspected bloom is an HCB. You can also use remote sensing to provide you with additional info on bloom size or characteristics before visiting the site. It's best if you identify your field sampling objectives before you go so you have the necessary sampling equipment. Once there, you can decide where on the water body to sample to give you the clearest picture of water conditions. Before you collect samples, consider the type of lab analysis you have in place and the sampling data required to issue a health advisory. As Ben mentioned in the previous training segment on monitoring, the monitoring section of the HCB guidance document and the interactive monitoring tool can help you to decide which sampling methods make sense for you. Communication and outreach are critical to an effective bloom response. You'll want to let the public and the media know what you know and don't know about the bloom and where they can go for additional information and updates during an HCB event. These information sources might include a dedicated website that offers regular updates on bloom conditions, call-in lines with pre-recorded messages, and social media channels. If possible, include information about how to report a potential HCB-related illness to your local poison control center or health agency. HCBs can impact drinking water sources, so you'll want to make sure you coordinate with the affected public water system if a bloom can or does affect its drinking water source. Under the best case scenario, the system already has a cyanotoxin management plan in place, but if not, the HCB guidance document on the ITRC website contains resources to help water systems prepare one. If the public water system doesn't have a plan, you can assist them by providing sampling data or collecting samples near plant intakes and outflows. The treatment plant might want to use alternative water sources until the bloom subsides. Public notification is crucial if a drinking water source is affected, particularly if the system is not equipped to remove cyanotoxins. A drinking water HCB fact sheet can help members of the public understand the situation and take appropriate actions to protect their health. Consistent signage helps the public understand the health risks in an area with an HCB. People want to know what kind of recreational activities are permitted or prohibited, and how they can protect themselves, their family, and their pets from exposure. Color coding and icons can help you to deliver your message quickly and succinctly. Plain language instructions increase public understanding and compliance with health recommendations. You might want to include more than one language on your signs to ensure your message reaches diverse populations. Experience has shown that many people are concerned about the health of their dogs, but may not be aware of the dangers posed by an HCB. So include information that helps dog owners keep their pets safe. You may also want to consider installing permanent signs at water bodies that experience frequent blooms. Health advisories protect public health and safety in the event of an HCB. It's best if advisory thresholds are established before a bloom occurs. Many jurisdictions develop health-based advisory thresholds for cell count concentrations and cyanotoxins and identify the agency with the authority to issue health advisories. You may want to create a flowchart with advisory thresholds, roles and responsibilities for issuing an advisory, and requirements for lifting an advisory. Consider how you'll post advisories, and remember, the more places you post this information, the better. Signs at the bloom location, a press release, a dedicated website with frequent updates, and social media platforms are all good ways to get the word out. It's important to provide members of the public with information about the health risks posed by exposure to HCBs and how they can protect themselves, their families, and their pets. Centralized reporting and data collection are key to effective incident reporting, so you'll want to identify an agency or organization the public can contact to report symptoms and the location of their exposure. Some states partner with their local poison control center or health agency to gather health data. When people report a human or animal illness related to an HCB exposure, be sure to notify the public so others can avoid areas that pose a health risk. So let's talk for a minute about how you could use risk communication to address an HCB. In this scenario, a dog becomes seriously ill after playing in the water at hypothetical Largeville Reservoir. Your agency suspects a harmful cyanobacterial bloom. Largeville and Smallburg residents are unfamiliar with HCBs and are worried about their health and safety. Fortunately, your agency has dealt with HCBs in other parts of the state, so you're prepared. Let's walk through the five steps of an immediate bloom response to see how your agency might handle this bloom event. So, step one, reporting, notification, and coordination. Your agency receives a call from a vet on your 24-hour HCB reporting line after treating a dog for suspected cyanotoxin poisoning. The vet tells you that the dog was playing around the boat ramp at Largeville Reservoir before falling ill. The duty officer on the report line notifies agency staff and partner agencies about the incident. State park staff volunteer to sample the area near the boat ramp that afternoon. You notify the public about the possible HCB using your social media channels and promise updates as soon as you know more. Step two, bloom confirmation. State park staff collect samples and deliver them to the lab before it closes for the day. Your agency has the samples analyzed for toxins since the dog fell ill so suddenly. The lab reports there are high levels of cyanotoxins in the samples. You immediately use all available media channels to let the public know what you know about the bloom and how people can protect themselves and their pets until more is known. This information helps people to stay calm. You direct residents and the media to your website and social media accounts for info and updates on the situation, and you provide a toll-free number for the local poison control center. Further investigation shows the bloom originated at Smallburg Lake. Your agency briefs city officials, directors of the scout camp, the state park, and county park officials on the situation. You also schedule a town hall for Largeville and Smallburg residents to answer questions. Step three, drinking water response. Drinking water staff at your agency contact the Largeville drinking water plant about the bloom. The utility doesn't have a cyanotoxin response plan, so your staff offer to collect samples at the plant intake and outflow. The plant closes the water intake from Largeville Reservoir and uses an alternate source until more is known about the extent of the bloom. The drinking water plant issues a press release to let residents know their drinking water is safe, along with the steps it's taking to protect public health. Step 4, health advisories. The local health department confirms that cyanotoxin levels exceed health advisory thresholds and closes the area of the Largeville Reservoir near the boat ramp. The rest of the reservoir and Smallberg Lake are put under a health advisory. The health department and your agency provide bilingual signage for the lake and reservoir and issue a press release to notify residents about the advisory. You also post the information to your social media accounts. Step 5, illness reporting. Several families recreating near the boat ramp experience vomiting and diarrhea a few days after the dog fell ill. They call the local poison control center to report their symptoms. The center staff collect their information, tell them to contact their physician, and put the information in the center's HCV database. So remember how we talked earlier about key messages and message mapping? Here are three key messages you might use to inform the public and media about the bloom. The messages are short and to the point and answer who, what, where, when, why, and how. The words highlighted in red show who is providing the information, what residents want and need to know, and how they can stay safe. Your agency identified a harmful cyanobacterial bloom in Smallbird Lake and Largeville Reservoir. The health department issued health advisories for toxins. Do not swim in the water and obey posted notices. So long-term bloom planning generally takes place during the off-season. This is the time to review lessons learned from the previous HCB season to prepare for the next. Notice that many of the features of long-term planning were critical to the successful response in the HCB scenario we discussed. Long-term response planning includes routine and response sampling and monitoring plans, drinking water emergency response planning, communication and outreach, collaboration with partners, data management optimization, evaluation of reporting and communication of HCB-related illnesses, and an evaluation of the current response plan. Risk communication is an important component of an effective bloom response. As we discussed at the beginning of this training, risk communication provides members of the public with the information they want and need to make informed decisions about the risk from HCBs. Planning is an integral part of the bloom response process. That's why it's important to develop immediate and long-term plans to address HCBs before, during, and after a bloom event. And finally, clear messaging and timely communication about HCBs build the trust and credibility needed for your agency to protect public health during a bloom event. You can find additional information in the risk communication section of the HCB guidance document, as well as the ITR risk communication toolkit, both available on the ITRC website. So next, Rob Newby will be covering in-lake management strategies.
Thanks, Gina. Make sure I have control. There we go. All right, go back a couple slides. There we go. All right, everybody. Welcome to Chapter 6 of the guidance document. In the previous modules, you learned about identification, response, and communication. In the next module, you'll learn about watershed level approaches. This section focuses on managing and controlling blooms in lakes and other water bodies. So typically, we're going to start with a help. We have a bloom. So what do we do next? Naturally, we hope that lake managers and stakeholders have explored ITRC's HCB resource before they're confronted with a crisis. However, we recognize that people might have arrived needing help. This section of the document is designed with that in mind. Our goal is to provide an organized and cohesive framework to learn about different strategies and evaluate their suitability for use in any given situation. The web portal allows users to browse online and download documents directly from Section 6 and the strategy fact sheets in Appendix C. It also allows users to explore options interactively using an online strategy selection tool. Let's take a tour. Let's dive right in to the guidance document. Section 6 is fairly short, but it's important. It provides an overview of considerations that apply broadly to all in-lake control and treatment strategies. It includes a review of some factors that you'll want to account for before selecting an approach. You'll also find a summary table listing the 24 strategies that were researched in depth. You'll notice that entries in this table are hotlinked. Those links in the table lead directly to Appendix C. This is where you'll find over 70 pages of detailed content. There is a downloadable fact sheet for each of the 24 strategies. There is also a cost comparison table and a short summary of about half a dozen additional strategies that were not covered in depth individually. The modular structure makes it easy for resource managers to focus on only strategies that are suitable for their situation. So how did the team decide on what strategies to include in the fact sheets? First, the strategies were limited to freshwater and estuarine water bodies rather than marine systems. We also focused on open surface water bodies and excluded treatment methods that were used primarily in drinking water or wastewater utilities. Engineered water systems have their own special considerations and a robust body of supporting research and literature. Most importantly, the strategies included are those that have been evaluated in peer-reviewed, mainstream scientific literature, or in a government agency white paper. There are a number of methods, both old and brand new, that at this time have primary anecdotal support or support only from vendors and have not yet been independently evaluated. These methods were not included. A quick side note, although the tool and fact sheets were originally focused on planktonic blooms, both the selection tool and the fact sheets have been updated to include benthic blooms and provide more comprehensive resource. All right. Let's take a look at a fact sheet. Each one is designed to stand alone, but they have a common structure to facilitate comparison. This one is for hypomimetic oxygenation and aeration. The header shows the strategy's utility for both planktonic and benthic blooms. A strategy is considered as an intervention if it's meant to be used on active blooms, whereas a prevention is used to reduce the likelihood or intensity of future blooms. Supporting data is considered substantial if evidence of effectiveness is clear and robust. For a strategy that has not been studied as thoroughly or has had some mixed results, it might be limited. Meanwhile, a relatively new method that has mostly laboratory rather than field support might be scored as emerging. Note that because there has been less research on benthic blooms, many strategies may be characterized as unknown/no data for them. The fact sheet starts with a general technical description, which may be illustrated with photos or diagrams. There is a checklist to summarize the conditions where the treatment has been demonstrated most effective and the type of bloom for which it's best suited. Later in the fact sheet, you'll find a summary of advantages and limitations. This is followed by a brief cost analysis, at least one case study, and any special notes about regulatory and policy considerations. The literature references for each fact sheet are also included to make further research easier for the user. So let's take a step back. Is choosing a strategy as easy as choosing a fact sheet that looks good? Of course not. If there were one perfect, affordable method for controlling blooms, every lake manager would be using it. Instead, we know that HCBs, like all other problems, are both complex and persistent. And this attracts many attempts at treatments and solutions. To use a medical analogy, the water body is not well, and HCBs are manifestations of sickness. We have a landscape of treatment options, old and new, short-term or long-term, more or less invasive, also more or less costly. There is no one universal solution. Different treatments that are better suited for particular cases. The more you know about your situation, the better odds of making a good choice are. This resource does not give prescriptions, but instead serves as a compendium that's aimed at providing a systemic overview of strategies that have support in the current peer-reviewed literature. It is not intended to promote one strategy over another, but to support informed decision-making, to help you consider the context, understand constraints, weigh pros and cons, and set realistic expectations for outcomes. For the best approach to decision making, we want to sort through options in a logical way. We can group strategies according to a variety of factors. And what are the top level considerations? Well, first, each strategy can be categorized as a prevention or intervention, like previously discussed, or both. An intervention is meant to be used on an active bloom, and a prevention is intended to decrease the likelihood of future blooms. Next, what type of water body is affected? Is it a pond, typically with a depth of less than 10 feet, a lake or reservoir, a larger water body with a residence time over a year, or a river? Finally, are you concerned primarily with planktonic or benthic blooms? As you'll see in a moment, these are the factors that serve as primary filtering criteria in the interactive management criteria selection tool on the web portal. If we are serious about identifying a strategy for a real-world situation, we want to collect some additional information. First, we want to know more about our particular water body. Characteristics like surface area and depth, residence time and mixing regime, and natural turbidity and chemistry will affect our choices. Also, if a lake is highly enriched, meaning it's eutrophic, it is important to know whether the input is from the watershed or from internal loading. Are there use-related factors that might limit choices? For example, is this a drinking water storage reservoir? Are there swimming beaches? Is it home to a protected species or invasive species that could influence our decisions? If your water body has seasonal influences to consider, for example, ice cover or regulated water level changes, make note of those too. And of course, we want to know as much as possible about the bloom. Is it a new problem? Or is there a history of frequent reoccurrence? When does it occur? Is there an element of seasonal predictability? What about the location and scale? Does it tend to start and accumulate in one area? And how bad is it? Is it mild or intense? Do you know what species are most abundant and whether cyanotoxins have been detected? Finally, there are always practical and human considerations. How important is bloom control relative to other management and use priorities? Are the littoral zones important for fish spawning? Is it more important to have swimmable beaches in July or safe drinking water year-round? Are there other management actions in place that could present conflicting goals? What are the logical constraints? The immediate budget, the ongoing budget, the available infrastructure and staffing? It's important to consider whether there are regulations that constrain options. For example, placing structures on the lake bed or applying algicides. This is going to vary from state to state and sometimes at a local or water body level. It's also important to consider stakeholder perspectives and overall risk tolerance of managers and community, including downstream neighbors, which is a major consideration for both rivers and reservoirs. With all this information assembled, we're ready to explore our options. As we know, the web portal offers Section 6 in Appendix C for online browsing or download. In addition, there is a management criteria tool which allows users to explore options interactively. Let's use it to explore a scenario on Smallberg Lake. What do we know about Smallberg Lake and what's happening there? This is a shallow, well-mixed 50-acre lake with unregulated outflow. It has a nutrient loading from septic systems, resident waterfowl, and probably from the row crops in the watershed. It is loosely managed by the county. There is a county park and a scout camp on the north side and a private shoreline on the south. Residents know that it gets green during most dry summers, but there has never been a real concern in the past. However, a visiting colleague from Large Hill Reservoirs recognizes this green as an HCB and tested the bloom and found toxins, which put an immediate stop to recreational use. The county is starting from scratch. They've never thought about HCB management before. They are interested in both intervention and prevention for this planktonic bloom. They are open-minded about options. They're willing to explore methods with limited or emerging field support, as well as substantial research evidence to support them. We note that this is a small recreational lake, well mixed with a long residence time. It is eutrophic, probably with some regular external nutrient loading. Rather than reading over 70 pages of fact sheets, they will start with the interactive, the management criteria tool, on the web portal to explore the 24 strategies that they apply the factors that were previously discussed. Because they are using broad selection criteria for a common water body type, only one option is eliminated as a candidate. However, using additional sorting factors in the output table, they're able to eliminate five more strategies, two that are not recommended for turbid lakes, which are acidification and UV exposure, and three that are not relevant for shallow lakes, artificial mixing, hypnolimatic oxygen, and hypnolimatic withdrawal. This diagram shows a list of 18 candidate prevention and intervention strategies. It includes strategies that have emerging, limited, and substantial supporting data. But in theory, they all might be possibilities for use in a relatively small, shallow system like Smallberg Lake. Five strategies are categorized as prevention only, four as intervention, and nine may be considered for both prevention and intervention. The next step is to investigate them further. Some stakeholders want the lake's problem to be fixed ASAP, and they're pressuring the county. So the county government convenes a stakeholder meeting with speakers from Largeville University, the county extension office, and lake managers from nearby Largeville Reservoir. The speakers remind everyone that there is no single prescription, so they need to discuss options. Now let's walk through the options with the stakeholder community. First, they eliminate monitored natural attenuation. They want something done now, before the 4th of July. Next, two physical methods are rejected: dredging, for being too invasive and expensive, and hydraulic flushing, because it's not compatible with the dam's outflow structure. Dye shading is rejected because it would change the lake's appearance. And after more research and discussion, several other methods are rejected for being too untested, unavailable, or expensive. And these include food web and microbial biomanipulation, nanoparticles, ozonation, organic biocides, and skimming and harvesting. Finally, the university expert cautions that phosphorus binding compounds and flocculation may not be the best solution, since the lake continues to have nutrient input from the watershed. So those are set aside for now too. The universe of options has been constrained through careful consideration. Fortunately, there are still some viable options to work with. They check with the State Department of Environmental Quality to see whether there are any regulatory constraints. They learn that all the remaining strategies are allowable, though some regulations may apply and permits may be necessary. The county decides to apply peroxide algicide lake-wide. If this doesn't work, they will have another meeting to discuss a one-time use of copper algicide. Next summer, the emphasis will be on prevention. The county, with volunteer help from the scouts, will install barley straw in the north part of the lake next spring. With some help from the golf course, the Homeowners Association is buying an ultrasound device for their corner of the lake. They will research floating wetlands as well. So to review, the stakeholder and management group has decided to adopt a variety of intervention and prevention approaches. The county does not want to treat the lake year after year, but they will hire a lake management company to knock down this year's bloom with algicide, first with peroxide, with chelated copper as a backup. During and after the algicide application, no recreational use will be permitted, and cyanotoxins will be monitored until they fall below levels of concern. Over the coming months, the county will work with the scout camp to acquire and install barley straw on the north shoreline next spring. Meanwhile, the Homeowners Association, with the help from the golf course, will buy an ultrasound unit and research floating wetland islands. As you may already have guessed, the county government has wisely recognized this is an opportunity to strengthen communication and monitoring. They are convening a stakeholder group that includes both lake and watershed interest, and they have agreed to provide lake-wide toxin monitoring, work with Largeville University to monitor results, and update the community through both traditional media and social media. Before implementing a strategy, let's go back to Section 6 of the document to make sure we're not forgetting anything. Yes, the county has done these things. As part of choosing a strategy, they've researched permit requirements and checked in with stakeholders. They have considered the possible side effects and deemed them acceptable, given the uses of the lake. They have gotten estimates from several different leak management companies and have reviewed short and long-term budget impacts as well as logistics. Finally, they are working with the communities to communicate their goals and their plans. Perhaps most importantly, the county now knows that in order to evaluate different strategies, it's important to monitor both before and after implementation in both the treated and control areas if possible. For Smallberg Lake, they are trying one strategy in the North Cove and one in the South. They plan to monitor conditions in both locations as well as at the dam where no treatment is being applied. With help from experts and students at Largeville University, they will collect samples for cytotoxins and cell counts on a weekly basis before and after the treatment, along with dissolved oxygen and nutrients. The county has asked the State Wildlife Agency and the State Regulatory Agency to review their plans. Both agencies agree that it's important to measure dissolved oxygen and toxins when they're applying any algaecide. They like the monitoring plan, and they note that the leak management contractor has been selected is familiar with the permit process. As we have seen with Smallberg Lake, for example, adaptive management will increase your odds of understanding success. HCBs are complex phenomena, and no two are exactly the same. So set realistic expectations, make methodical, careful decisions based on as much data as possible, but remain flexible and learn from every attempt, whether successful or not. This is how adaptive management works. That first toxic bloom can induce panic. So it may require conscious effort to take a step back and look at the big picture, to consider the fiscal, practical, and ecological consequences of any approach. Use the event as an opportunity to recruit allies and communicate with stakeholders. If intervention strategies are planned, determine well in advance what cue will trigger an intervention. And of course, throughout implementation of any strategy, include a monitoring plan that will close the loop and allow you to assess the effectiveness of your management and control efforts. One final note. The fact sheets presented in Appendix C do not include everything on the market today, and certainly not everything that will be on the market tomorrow. Complex, persistent problems continue to inspire many attempts to solve them, and new options are emerging constantly. When you encounter a new option, evaluate it systematically by asking the same questions. Are there peer-reviewed, independent field studies available? Does the evidence match the claims? Does it fit our water body and management goals? What are the upfront and recurring costs? How often does the treatment need to be applied and to what extent? What are the possible short and long-term impacts to the water body? Is this strategy reversible or will it leave a lasting impact? Are there possible side effects of residuals? So what are our key takeaways? As we have seen, the options can seem overwhelming, but remember that if there were one perfect solution, everyone would be using it. You'll improve your odds of success by learning as much as you possibly can about your water body and the bloom. Then set goals realistically relative to the water body's uses and fiscal and other constraints. Consider whether a proposed strategy treats a symptom or addresses underlying causes, include a well-designed monitoring plan with your treatment so that you can evaluate how effective it is. You can use the management and control section of the ITRC guidance document to help you work through all the steps and considerations. And most importantly, understand that in-lake management strategies are just one part of a bigger picture that includes understanding and monitoring of HCBs, response and communication, and watershed management. And with that mention of watershed management, I'd like to reintroduce Ben from Utah.
Excellent. Thank you, Rob. All right, so let's jump into our final module, Strategies for Use and Nutrient Management. This module covers Section 7 of the document. So to provide some initial context, I plan to discuss these four categories of nutrient management with you today. A review of the factors influencing HCBs, steps for success, the ITRC HCB web portal and tools, and an application of a scenario with these tools. So as you may have learned through the introduction training module, there are a number of known variables that contribute to HCBs, and yet there are many unknowns that influence the extent, magnitude, and duration of these blooms. Nutrients, light availability, and temperature, and the timing of the three as they relate to seasonal growth, strongly influence planktonic HCB formation. However, of these variables, nutrients are the contributor that we can only hope to control on a local level that may lead to preventing blooms. The most prominent source of nutrients will vary by location, making it important for water managers to understand the land use and the surrounding area. There's significant difficulty removing nutrients from our waterways. They're pervasive and found naturally throughout our watersheds. They're intertwined with our everyday life. They're persistent and can accumulate within a watershed. Finally, they are a necessity for growth and ecological function. So optimal amounts will vary with time and location. In this training and our guidance, we place more emphasis on the carrot approaches to reducing nutrients. However, there are regulatory aspects with controlling nutrients within many states that can be employed, which can assist with the stick approach when needed. These nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus, are typically the elements that limit growth in the terrestrial and particularly aquatic ecosystems where planktonic HCBs occur. So as more are added to the system, more growth occurs. Let's briefly cover how human activities can increase the levels of these nutrients in our water bodies. So we'll start with phosphorus. In contrast to its elemental form, which is used every day in our LED light bulbs, it's found as phosphate outside the laboratory. So as an element and a molecule, it's sticky. So aside from point source effluent discharges, it's generally related to sediment erosion and transport within your watershed. In terms of sources, there are a few major contributors, such as waste disposal and runoff from animals and humans, where it's applied as a concentrated fertilizer for crop growth. And when industrial applied, in detergents or for production of materials. As for nitrogen, besides its use in the explosion of airbag deployment, nitrogen is most commonly found in a gaseous form. Because of that, its cycling in the natural environment is more complicated than phosphorus, and therefore limiting nitrogen and having the same effect is more complicated. Particularly if you recall from the introduction module that some cyanos can fix nitrogen from the atmosphere and bring it into the aquatic environment. Nonetheless, it too shares a number of sources similar to those of phosphorus. For this training and our guidance, we're not wading into the debate of whether reducing phosphorus or nitrogen is more important. Both are important for growth, so it greatly depends on the ecology of your water body, the relative contributions from sources within the watershed and water body, and the timing of when these nutrients are available in molecular form for cyanobacteria growth. With that said, it's critically important that you understand whether the dominant sources of the nutrients are arriving from outside the lake, that is, external loading from the watershed, or is it predominantly originating from within the lake itself, which is termed internal loading. Depending on the depth of your water body, internal loading may occur through different mechanisms. Shallow water bodies may experience internal loading due to resuspension of sediments from wave action, whereas deeper waters may experience this loading through a chemical reaction when oxygen levels at the sediment surface become depleted, which results in phosphorus and nitrogen molecules being released. Then, depending on mixing ability, such as the turnover frequency in the stratified lake, the nutrients become available to primary producers like cyanobacteria. So this training module focuses on nutrient management strategies that originate from external loading. For ideas that tackle nutrients due to internal loading, please revisit the in-lake treatment training, which is module 4, and visit section 6 of that document. For practical purposes, it's critical to tackle your external sources of nutrients first, or the strategies applied to internal loading will likely be short-lived. There are numerous approaches and strategies to cover this topic. The HCB team created this section and web portal to assemble relevant information that we found useful into one place. However, if you're following these basic steps, it'll help organize your approach implementing these strategies successfully. Some steps may require substantial resources, but even limited amounts of data information may be very useful in identifying priorities. The steps are exploring these issues with regulatory agencies, gathering information, developing actions that secure community cooperation, determine critical areas for implementation of nutrient management strategies, implementing those strategies using the most efficient and targeted approaches, and finally, evaluating the effectiveness, adapting, and documenting and sharing those lessons learned and success stories. So first, we'll start with step one, exploring the issues with your regulatory agencies. So it's important that you first contact your local and state agencies to determine whether nutrients have been identified as an issue in your watershed and whether watershed plans or nutrient concentration goals, such as watershed loads or site-specific criteria, have already been developed for the HCB-affected water body. More information regarding this step can be found in section 7.2. Next is to gather the information and the data. Characterize relative nutrient loading using models and monitoring as necessary. Identify predominant nutrient sources in the watershed and prioritize nutrient sources for reduction. Leverage your local knowledge. Review permitting databases. If no previous assessment exists, check out US EPA's How's My Waterway, because it was designed to provide information collected from states, tribes, and local agencies related to the condition of water bodies throughout the U.S. Consider using nutrient source tracking to assist with characterizing primary nutrient sources, and visit the recovery potential screening tool that was designed for your state, which is also found on EPA's website. More information regarding this step can be found in section 7.3, which provides specific examples and resources. Step three, discover and reach out to affected stakeholders. So build outreach and education into your program. This is a critical step that's often overlooked because resource managers tend to focus on the technical issues. Stakeholders can provide assistance by seeking information and filling data gaps identified in the previous steps. They can seek funding and funding strategies. In fact, many of the success stories that we've discovered share the trait of funding through shared partnerships. Stakeholders also assist by implementing projects. When developing your outreach, consider the languages, culture, events, and demographics of the place and community. Also consider conducting educational outreach at schools. For additional information on this subject, visit section 7.2. And in addition, for specific examples and resources for this objective, review the HCB web portal and HCB risk communication in section 5. Step 4, prioritize your actions. So this step is really where your efforts will pay off. It's also the most difficult step because there are a multitude of potential actions that can lead to nutrient reduction in a myriad of scenarios. The ITRC has emphasized our efforts towards compiling these strategies into a single location with an easy-to-use graphic that categorizes strategies based on nutrient sources. Visit section 7.4 for more information, and later in this training, I'll cover a scenario on how to use the tools we've created to assist you with these decisions. Step 5, implementing the strategies. All right, so this is usually the fun and exciting, fulfilling step. You get to spend all the funds that your team worked hard to secure. Just remember, physical and structural strategies that you plan to employ ensure that you have secured the appropriate permits before implementation. There are numerous case studies and examples found throughout Section 7 of the document, so please visit there. And finally, step 6, effectiveness monitoring. As mentioned in Module 4, before implementing all these steps, it's critical to devote time incorporating a monitoring plan that documents whether the actions that you've taken were successful. This is particularly important when justifying the cost expended for the project to the funding entities, and it's also helpful for securing future funding, as well as identifying lessons learned from unsuccessful projects, because not everything is going to be perfectly executed or result in what you intended. To put these steps into context, it's helpful to remember that excess nutrients can be regulated under the Clean Water Act. There are mechanisms to achieve reductions through these means. However, because nutrients can originate from both regulated, that is, point sources, and unregulated sources, non-point sources, most effective successes occur through a combination of regulatory and incentive programs. When you get started, it's important to ask these kinds of questions. Have goals been established? Have total maximum daily loads been established? Have load allocations been implemented into discharge permits? For more information, please visit Section 7.2. All right, so we've broken nutrient sources into point and non-point sources. Point sources are regulated. Non-point sources aren't regulated unless a TMDL has been approved for that water body. The document categorizes point sources into municipal and industrial discharges, stormwater, and agricultural, specifically as confined animal feeding operations or CAFOs. As I mentioned, non-point sources aren't regulated, but there are a number of established programs that incentivize nutrient reduction practices. Non-point sources were categorized as agriculture, septic wastewater management, forest management, roadway management, and hydrologic or habitat modification, such as shoreline or riparian or wetlands. It's also important to consider water quality trading. So water quality trading spans both point and non-point categories because it's typically deployed as a tool across these nutrient source categories. Water quality trading is based on the premise that nutrient control from some sources may require costly measures, while measures to reduce the same nutrient at other sources are less expensive. So for example, this may arise when treating nutrients at a point source becomes prohibitively more expensive than if those funds were deployed within the watershed at other sources that could reduce nutrients even more. Trading allows greater, less costly nutrient reductions from one source to be transferred to another source where reductions may be more expensive. This flexibility allows for better outcomes at lower costs. Water quality trading promotes nutrient reduction at lower costs while advancing improved environmental conditions. Visit Section 7.7 to learn more about that. So now, let's showcase some of the tools we've assembled. First, this strategy selection graphic. So each red dot corresponds to the point or non-point source categories that I just described. Hovering over the dot pops up a window that provides links to the strategies. The strategies include links to resources and examples of these strategies in use across the country. The strategies were broken into two themes, structural and non-structural. Structural strategies in nutrient management typically incorporate physical treatment, which can be either passive and natural or active and mechanical, such as sedimentation, filtration, absorption, ion exchange, or disinfection. Non-structural strategies are generally programmatic in nature, such as education and outreach, regulation and enforcement, maintenance, or source control. In addition, we've compiled these strategies into an easy-to-read table, which is found in section 7.4. Again, just clicking on any of those hyperlinks will bring you up into those respective strategies. So let's go through a scenario. And this scenario will mainly focus the objectives of step four, the identify and prioritizing strategy step. So this is Largeville Reservoir, and it has high recreational use. It's got a swimming beach, a county boat ramp, fishing and boating, et cetera. Also, it's a source of drinking water. There's a city water intake that's below the reservoir, and a rural water intake that's near the top of the reservoir, as you can see here. The rural water intake annually receives reports of taste and odor issues, and these reports tend to co-occur when cyanobacteria blooms are reported in the area. So zooming out, and looking upstream, we can see several potential nutrient sources. Again, here's that rural water intake. We've got a farm town that is has feedlots, et cetera, that go into a tributary. And then we also have a village called Smallburg, and it has a wastewater treatment plant and also some local sources. But as you notice, the wastewater treatment plant goes into a tributary that enters the reservoir below the rural water intake. So it's likely that wastewater treatment plant is not a large contributing factor to the source of nutrients that are impacting that rural water intake. But let's dive in a little deeper here. Here in that village of Smallburg and Smallburg Lake, they've got a considerably enriched lake that has cabins with septic on the side, golf courses, plenty of waterfowl, including Goose Island. Also, I can notice that there's a row crop land use and county park with boat ramp and fishing dock nearby. So if we were to take that scenario and apply it to our strategy selection graphic, the two types of strategies we'd wish to take a deeper look at would be something along the lines of septic systems that are associated with those cabins, or strategies that can best address CAFO conditions. So as I'm hovering over these red dots, these boxes will pop up with a hyperlink to the strategies. And if I were to click on one of those strategies, let's say septic systems, it would pop up a narrative that would describe those conditions and walk you through an example of strategies that are targeted towards improving nutrient reduction in septic systems. Additionally, we could further on in that document, it describes the pros and cons of each of those strategies, regulatory considerations, and links to examples of these strategies. So let me quickly touch upon a disclaimer and a cautionary tale. The climate is changing faster than our ability to reduce nutrients in water bodies. A rapidly changing climate may confound any attempts to prevent cyanoblooms, but controlling and reducing nutrient availability to these blooms is our best hope to reduce the extent, magnitude, and duration of these events. I'd like to add Lake Erie provides a cautionary tale that managing nutrients is a constant issue. Nutrients were greatly reduced through point sources at the advent of the Clean Water Act, but through time, those reduction efforts were overcome through non-point sources that began to exceed those efforts. So just wanted to relay that we may not be successful to prevent cyanobacteria blooms occurring in all situations, but at least reducing some aspects of HCBs would be considered a success. Finally, there are many success stories, and we've identified a number of them. It's important to consider that a long-term full-court press is necessary to reduce excess nutrients from our at-risk water bodies, and that reducing nutrients in waterways takes tremendous fortitude and perseverance, and it's not a quick fix. And finally, it's critical that you document and share your strategies and stories. And with that, I will turn it over to Devin for questions.
All right. Thank you so much, Ben and trainers. Let me just take remote control back here. Okay, so we're going to jump right into our final Q&A session here, and then we'll wrap up the training and wish everybody a great rest of their day. So the first question we have is there any development on in-situ data calibrated ANN model for HAB prediction?
Yeah, this is Gina. I had to look up what your acronym was. So you're asking about like neural network modeling for HAB prediction. I'm not sure. I know there is a lot of research into things like that, but one of the caveats is that in many cases, the specific triggers for bloom growth and toxin production are water body specific. So a lot of that effort tends to be focused on large water bodies, for example, the Western Basin of Lake Erie, which has really severe blooms and toxin production, and also binational efforts to monitor the blooms. So a lot of effort towards that. I can't really give you any specifics, unfortunately, but it's definitely a growing area of research in cyanobacteria.
Gina. So I'll pause. We don't have any questions right now, so I'll pause and just do some quick wrap-up logistics, and if we get any more, then I'll read them. But I just wanted to remind everybody that we do have the second part to this training on October 12th. So that is going to be next Thursday, is HCB's benthic. I will put the link in the chat here, but if you registered for this course, you should be registered for HCB too. So we look forward to seeing you there. And then I would also just like to remind everybody that if you're looking for a certificate of completion for today's webinar, you're going to be able to get one of those by completing the feedback form that's located on the Kluin training page. I'll drop that in the chat here for everybody to find. So we'd love for you to fill that form out, whether or not you need a certificate, just to let us know how the training went today. So with that, I'll pause and look back to our Q&A pod. And if we don't have any other questions, then I will wrap up and send everybody off onto their day. That's it. So I'd just like to take a moment and say thank you to our attendees for joining us today, and a special thank you to our expert trainers that joined us today, Gina, Ben, and Rob. Really appreciate making the time, and hopefully we'll see everybody next Thursday for part two. So with that, I'll wish everybody a wonderful rest of their day, and please just let us know if you have any questions, comments, or concerns. Our email is itrc@itrcweb.org. So with that, I will wish everybody a great rest of their day.